5 o'clock, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, 90.9 on cable, and streaming online at www.cfrc.ca. We're broadcasting live from the basement of Crothers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston on Turtle Island, and you're now tuned in to Radio 613. Okay, hello listeners, welcome to Radio 613. My name is Avi, and thanks a lot for tuning in for another week here on CFRC 101.9 FM. I'm definitely pleased to be on air. Unfortunately, the only Radio 613 collective in studio with you. However, we do have lots of musical guests, not live, but recorded guests joining us, as well as a phone guest who we'll be speaking to in calling from Guelph, speaking about the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner coming up there. And we'll be talking about guests in general, Ushpizin, for the holiday of Sukkot, which we're now in the midst of. And of course, a Chag Sameach to the listeners. And it's a really wonderful, joyful time of the year. And we'll be speaking about the holiday of Sukkot, what's been going on here with the family in Kingston, and also talking about some Ushpizin who we'd like to have in the Sukkah. I'm going to be reading an obituary later in the show, and a lot more. So keep tuning in. We're going to begin with a Sukkot-inspired tune by Frank London's Klezmer Brass All-Stars. The song is called In Your Garden, 20 Fecund Fruit Trees. We'll be right back. Okay, some circus music for the listeners here on Radio 613, broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston. We just heard from the Klezmer Conservatory Band with Ois is Good, and Frank London's Klezmer Brass Orchestra with In Your Garden, 20 Fecund Fruit Trees. Some really great music to begin the show. I was really into it. And joyful harvest music, I guess you could say, for the holiday circus, which is, in fact, one of our harvest holidays, along with Shavuot and Pesach. And I heard a Rav speaking in the summer about how circus is actually considered, you know, the most, you can just call it the holiday of joy. You don't need any other words to qualify or anything like that, because it's in fact not a harvest holiday where we're planting seeds or working with the crops, but it's actually the harvest holiday, the where we're gathering the crops. It's the Chag HaAsif, so we're doing the gathering and we're appreciating them, and we're going to get to consume them to the benefit of our lives, our health, the health of our family and community. So that's a really nice thing. It's also immediately following the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur period, certainly a very solemn period, contemplating life, death, very heavy concepts, and it's sort of a time where we can have that a bit of lightness and contrast. But something that I do like that's also in contrast to the just straight expression of joy, or maybe not in contrast, but to supplement it, is the building of the sukkah, which is, we talked about it on our sukkah show last year, but it's the temporary hut that we build that is meant to do a few things. Some ideas, certainly we are commemorating the experience of wandering in the desert following exodus from slavery, and I do like that idea of building something specifically in a period where we're meant to be so joyful, like a sukkah, a temporary hut, something that will remind us of that period of enslavement, of oppression. So that, you know, that's always something to be considered. There's no time, even in a joyful time, even during Chagim, and Simchas, we remember and make sure that we are thinking about our own oppressions and those of others around us. I also like the sukkah because the idea of building a sukkah, because it's sort of some very good opulence prevention, which I think a lot of parts of the Jewish community in North America could use a little opulence prevention. It's sort of like, you know, how do we celebrate a time where we're actually commanded to be joyful, which is another discussion maybe for another show, the implications of that. But there's certainly many instances we can think of where money is used to, and material thing, abundance is used to create a sense of joy, however artificial. And the sukkah is certainly not that. If the listeners have not sat in a sukkah, it's meant to be made from at least two walls that are human-made. So the one that we built this year has a 2x4 frame and some quarter-inch plywood walls, and then some brick wall from in the backyard. And then the roof is made out of schach, which is an organic substance, something grown from the ground. So we've got some branches and corn stalks up there. So it's certainly meant to be a place where you can dwell, you can sit in it and eat. And the schach, the roof, is meant to be such where you can, it's sort of providing protection, but at the same time you can see the stars. So certainly not the life of luxury in a sukkah, as wonderful as it is. So I do like that sort of check on having a joyful time be a time of, you know, spending money. And of course we also are humbled by the experience in the sukkah and recognize that the material things we do have are temporary, and also that perhaps, to maintain this feeling of joy, we need to recognize the poverty, the greed, the exploitation that's happening all around us, such that something like a house is not a luxury and a privilege for all people at all times. You know, definitely it's a year of here on Turtle Island where that's especially relevant. In America, we see the capitalist greed of insurance companies basically robbing people of houses. In America, we see ongoing disaster in New Orleans as the racist neglect of the American state during Katrina was followed by push towards gentrification and people not being able to return to their homes. And here closer to Kingston, we see ongoing, well, certainly gentrification in these corners as well, and ongoing attempts at dispossession and ongoing colonization of indigenous lands. Certainly there's resistance going on in Tyendinaga and some successful occupations of quarries that were being used on indigenous land and Tyendinaga Mohawk territory, and similar actions, to prevent environmental degradation in Six Nations and elsewhere nearby. So some folks down in Guelph have organized an anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner. And coming up after the break, we're going to be speaking with one of the organizers and attendees of the dinner, which is coming up, Matt, in Guelph. So definitely keep tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM and Radio 613. Lots more coming up. We're back here on the show speaking a little bit about the holiday of Sukkot, and just before that tune, talking about wanting to bring this concept of the temporariness of a house and material things, and why we build a sukkah even during the joyous time of the harvest, to remind us of that, and also wanting to sort of have the holiday provide us with an opportunity to continue to reflect and think about, you know, what it means to be a settler on Turtle Island, what it means to live on stolen land, and you know, even during times of joy. So I thought it'd be great to have on the show people or someone from Guelph who was organizing the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner, sort of joyous anti-colonial event that I was looking forward to hearing more about. So on the phone we have Matt. Welcome to Radio 613.
Thank you.
So tell us how the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner came about. Is it an annual event or?
Yeah, the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner has been going on for 5 years now in Guelph, and it started out, I started it out with a couple friends 5 years ago out of a residence at the university, and we pulled together an event and pulled in 75 people, and we had like five or six different speakers, and we did it all in a budget of $6. And it was a pretty incredible event. And where we originally heard about the idea was in Montreal. They used to do ACT dinners, but they've now since stopped that. But it's really grown in Guelph, and it's a really awesome event. It usually coincides like a week before, a week after Colonial Thanksgiving. And it's generally, we bring in different speakers from indigenous communities, and usually because of where we're based on the Grand River watershed, we bring in lots of people from the Haudenosaunee or Six Nations to talk about essentially land struggles and development and colonialism that's affecting them and their communities. And we've had a lot of different people from the Warrior Society come and speak with us to talk about resistance to that, and it's a pretty incredible event. And last year we had 150 people come out, and it's just been growing year after year after year, and this year's going to be pretty promising, I think.
That's wonderful. What is going to go on this year as far as speakers or the setting for the dinner?
This year we've got it at a local venue called the Guelph Youth Music Center, and it's essentially just that. It's a center focusing on youth and music programming for people in the community, and it's going to be in this big, beautiful foray beside the Speed River, and we're going to have a large potluck feast, which hopefully will feature. We tried to make the connection this year with food sovereignty and tying in the food politics aspect to dinner. So we've made connections with a lot of the local community shared agriculture or CSA farms within the community, and asked them if we can exchange either money or time or create some sort of a barter system in order to get a bunch of local foods, local organic foods, like donated, in order for the meal to really tie in that, like the need for local foods and an emphasis on that. And we're probably going to have five speakers. We haven't confirmed them yet, but Sean Brandt is probably going to come down. We're going to have a woman named Missy Elliott from Six Nations come up to speak about youth organizing on the reserve, and someone from the Mohawk Workers to talk about a reclaimed social space in Brantford that they've taken, that is an ex-Mohawk tourist attraction that is now being used for youth organizing and nation-to-nation organizing and sovereignty organizing. And we've also been talking with folks from Akwesasne to discuss the issues of the border crossing and the arming of the border guards on their territory. And we've also had a chat with someone who's been organizing with the No 2010 Olympics campaign on the West Coast, who's now living in Montreal, and we're asking her if she can come down to speak about it. So a lot of different issues that are facing Indigenous communities all across Turtle Island.
Oh, that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Definitely hope to make it down for that. So this sort of, as you said, came out of, from what I understand, a lot of like a desire for settler solidarity during a time where sort of colonial history is especially literally rammed down people's throats with Thanksgiving dinner. Is that right?
Yeah. We've part of the event has always been kind of it's always got a changing crowd and lots of new people to the concepts of like settler and indigenous like relations, and a lot of people who may not have regularly like questioned the fact that this has all been stolen land and none of it has really ever been, or that Canada itself really shouldn't exist. But it's been really impressive. We started it out moments before the reclamation site, or Ganistaudin in Six Nations or Caledonia, mm-hmm. which was a huge struggle for that community, and really, really kind of like woke up the world again to the fact that these indigenous people have been continually ripped off and had their land stolen from them, and that that their cultures are dying in conjunction with the loss of their land and the loss of their traditions. And so it started around then, and it's always been tied in with like the struggles for land that have been happening around town, and it's helped develop a strong connection between Guelph and the indigenous communities, as well as the other work that we've been doing in the community. But definitely bringing folks down, we've made strong connections with folks in Tandanega who've come out to speak at our events, and there's been lots of physical manifestations of the anti-colonial allies in Guelph. There's been three road blockades in solidarity with the Haudenosaunee, different Haudenosaunee communities when they've been victims of government repression, and there's also been on the AFN's National Day of Action, there was a large demonstration, I think that was 3 years ago, in the downtown square, where about 150 people came out to show their support for indigenous sovereignty and recognizing and settling these land issues that face Canada. And it's also from there, these connections have also extended into our own work as settlers trying to live up to the two-row wampum and the issues of development in these cities. And in Guelph recently, there was over the summer, there was an occupation by settlers of the Hanlon Creek Business Park, which is an industrial business park going in the south end, on essentially around a provincially significant wetland and old growth forest, and a lot of other sketchy things that led the occupiers to halt work there. And that's really that itself, and the people here in Guelph taking this the anti-colonial aspects of and like knowledge and tying that together with the two-row wampum, and then
right.
bringing that into action has been a strong bonding point, and it's been a really powerful thing where our connections with these indigenous communities are, hopefully we're trying to work up to a point where we're once again like standing on level ground, and kind of with the two-row wampum, where it's a canoe and a ship, so the Europeans and the indigenous nations are running parallel to each other and not rocking each other's boats, and so we're trying just to live up to that, and it's been pretty inspiring.
Yeah, definitely. I know that one of the sort of banners that some people were organizing under during that Hanlon Creek Business Park occupation was that of land is more important than sprawl. I don't know if that's a group or anything that you're part of, but can you talk a little bit about that concept within the sort of anti-colonial framework that you were speaking about?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, like the Hanlon Creek Business Park occupation came out of a broader struggle in this city against sprawl and against development that has taken on many different faces. Like about 5 or 6 years ago, Guelph, there was a lot of people in Guelph who were organizing in a very public fashion against the development of a Walmart in this town. And there was a long fight, and eventually it was lost. and they did get the Walmart in, but there's always been a history in this town. There's been there was once 4 years ago an ELF chapter that was active in Guelph that was doing anti-development work, and there's been more recently there's a library, and in conjunction with this library, a bunch of townhouses and yuppie condominiums that are going into the downtown, and that was also opposed. And there's been kind of lots of, within Guelph and within Southern Ontario in a broader context, there's been lots of opposition to development, and a lot of like the stuff that I was involved in with like the Hanlon Creek Business Park was also rooted in this anti-capitalist and anti-colonial frameworks and mindsets, where we saw it as not only like was there an issue, there's like issues with this, it was the city who was developing this business park, and there's lots of issues with like the lack of input and respect for the like people of Guelph into like where this project was heading, but also it was the Hanlon Creek watershed, its headwaters come from the site that they wanted to build it on. Mm. So, and the Hanlon Creek feeds into the Speed River, which feeds into the Grand River, and so there's also issues about how this and all the developments in Guelph affect and pollute the whole watershed and send it down into Six Nations, where like when there's heavy rains, we were told, I heard at a water forum we had here last year with someone from Six Nations, he was talking about how when there's heavy storms or when there's heavy rains in Southern Ontario, the water treatment plants are like all the toxic waste that gets flushed down the watersheds and flushed out of these communities and these sectors, like these industrial sectors of all the communities north and upwater from the Grand River and the Six Nations territory, it gets flushed down, and there's water advisories every time this happens because you can't drink water out of your taps because of all the toxics that people and like the communities and the businesses and the corporations and the cities north of or upstream of the Six Nations are just flushing into the watershed. And so there's also issues of the fact that like Guelph sits on neutral territory, and it's also under some definitions a part of the Haldimand Track, which is an unceded treaty that the Haudenosaunee Nation made with Canada in its first formation, or the British Crown originally, and so just within all those contexts we've really tried to incorporate that in, and we've worked with the Haudenosaunee, which is the men's fire out of Six Nations, and they've come up, they've spoke at press conferences with us and addressed letters and to both the developer, the city, and to the contractors who've been working on this project so far, telling them that they need to cease and desist, that they haven't consulted the Haudenosaunee or the Haudenosaunee, and that project shouldn't go forward. And so there's been lots of we've always tried to tie in that anti-colonial analysis to these struggles.
Right, and from what I understand, the occupation that happened of the Hanlon Creek Business Park did put the development on hold, at least for the time being. Is that right?
Yeah, people's original ambitions for the project or for the occupation was to stop it for the summer because of certain time restrictions with them building a culvert over the tributary of the Hanlon Creek. Mm-hmm. And the occupation and the subsequent injunction that we had against the city from work on the culvert pushed the deadlines back too far, that it wasn't realistic for them to complete the project this year, and so we were able to shut it down until the next spring. So we were able to stop it for one whole year, which was very effective and was exactly what we were looking for at that time, and it gives us more opportunities to work against this development and shutting it down.
I wanted to just turn back to the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner, and I think it's just seems like a really creative and good sort of tool for settler education. So settler education, maybe. So I want to ask you about that, about if there are other sort of tactics being used, or maybe just you said this event has grown a lot and there's a broad range of people who come, and sort of what kind of it clearly seems like a successful thing going 5 years in a row, and certainly with building relationships with various indigenous groups in the region, but also reaching out to other settlers and doing some sort of educational project that also involves, bringing people together, eating together, and that sort of thing. So yeah, I don't know if you had any other thoughts on that.
It's been very effective. Last year we had in conjunction with this, a lot of it's a project, like this dinner has been a project that's really inspired a lot of people, and a lot of people have gotten involved and continually get involved with it, and so it means that we have a lot of things coming out at this time too. It's a time in the season where we can reflect on all the work that has happened so far, and celebrate the past year. And it's been really effective. We've been able, last year we've released zines in conjunction with the ACT dinner before. Mm-hmm. And we've also had art released with it. Last year we had Sarah Dover come down, and she spoke and she talked about she's a settler who's a lawyer on behalf of Aboriginal and Indigenous people of mostly Six Nations, and she helps them fight in the courts, and she had a very impassioned talk where she talked about the need for settlers to get involved in this struggle, that it's not like being an ally with the Six Nations and the Haudenosaunee. It's not just about just providing support and money or going down to cook on their sites, but it's also about getting out there and stopping these developments, because it's not just a native issue. The effects that these developments are having, the effects that these water treatment plants or in Six Nations today, they were down there stopping the Edwards landfill, which is a dump site that's over top of their watershed and polluting the aquifers that their community drinks out of. And these are not isolated instances to native communities, and so it's really that focus is really developed, and it keeps coming back more and more, and I think people are really, really appreciating and seeing themselves and how they themselves play into colonialism, but also how the broader systems and state power that exists here also plays into how they themselves are screwed over through the continuation of colonialism and the continuation of land theft and the destruction of the land and the environment. And so I think it's a really good event, and Sarah Dover put it really well when she explained when she spoke last year, and we made a zine out of her talk, but she just explained how Aboriginal people and Indigenous people will never get justice within the Canadian legal system, because they are sovereign and they don't fit underneath the Canadian justice system, and the justice system can't ever deliver them sovereignty. They can only get it through their own means, and with that, the Canadian state will always be in conflict with Indigenous communities as long as it continues on its path as it is. And so I think with the settler-to-settler education, it's been really, really effective. I've seen just personally from having Sarah Dover talk, or having this event organized exclusively by settlers, and having having it be a settler-initiated thing, it provides an atmosphere where people can really feel comfortable challenging and thinking about how they play into colonialism and what colonialism means today and what it's meant from over 500 years ago when Europeans first started coming to this land.
Right. gonna have to let you go soon. Is that I was just wondering if you mentioned that you put together a zine. I'm wondering if that's available online. It's something that we can link to, or maybe if you just have any good resource sites to recommend, for the listeners.
Yeah, there's a website called anti-politics.net that has PDFs online that are a wide variety of Warrior Publication, which is indigenous graphic novel comic styles, as well as educational pamphlets about all aspects of colonialism. And the ACT Dinner zine will be online sometime in the next month or two, but it's not on there yet. And so there's that, and then there's the hcbpoccupation.wordpress.com, and that's a website about the Business Park Development in Guelph, and they, folks from the occupation, are going to be hosting a talk or a workshop prior to the ACT Dinner about development in Guelph and colonialism in Guelph and way different developments that are happening in Guelph and the opposition to them.
Great. Well, we'll get links to those up on the show's website. Matt, thanks a lot for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it, and definitely wish you the best with the anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner. The date for that again is
It's October 23rd at 5 is the workshop and 6 is the dinner.
great. All right, take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Time to talk, man, no time for games. It's time to block highways and block the drains. Your money, cause I want change, and we ain't all tame like Bill Fontaine. Shouldn't we be enraged if they kidnapped kids and kept them encaged? Caught the propaganda, poisoned the brains, so that the whole culture made them ashamed. And don't tend the thousands and no more graves. Canadian genocide, Trojan state, Canadian genocide, never again. Total Island is getting reclaimed. Protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. We got one plan, let's protect what's left. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. Protect Mother Earth, don't settle for less. This is Total Island, don't you ever forget. This is Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leafs, we'll never fly the fucking flag again. This is Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leafs, we'll never fly the fucking flag again. This is Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leafs, we'll never fly the fucking flag again. This is Canada, this is Total Island, man. Fuck the Maple Leafs, we'll never fly the fucking flag again.
This October 16th to 18th, CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston hosts the National Campus and Community Radio Association's Ontario Regional Conference. From Friday, October 16th through Sunday, October 18th, join with student and community radio broadcasters from across our region for 2 days of informative workshops and panels and 2 nights of innovative, independent audio entertainment. All events will be held free of charge. However, advance registration is required. For more information, visit www.cfrc.ca or www.ncra.ca. Mark your calendars for the Ontario Regional Campus and Community Radio Conference, October 16th to 18th.
Yes, the National Campus Radio Association Regional Conference is happening here, that's right, in Kingston, October 16th to 18th, 2009. I want to encourage everyone to come out, radio makers, radio listeners, everyone should come to this wonderful conference that happily CFRC is hosting this year. So you can register online at cfrc.ca and check out the really great lineup of workshops and events. I'm going to be speaking at the workshop, giving a panel called, I'm going to be on a panel called Spirituality and Community Radio, and that's going to be with the hosts of Study of the Muslim Species, we've had on the show here before for our Abrahamic Handoff show, and also Karen Holmes, who has a children's great CFRC show. That's on October 17th at 3 p.m. if you're interested. But definitely lots of great workshops, some production stuff, DJ, technical workshops, discussions about anti-oppression, consensus-based decision-making on community radio. So definitely check it out. The show's coming quickly to a close. I wanted to read something for the listeners before that happened. One of the practices of Sukkot is welcoming of guests, Ushpizin. In fact, last year we did a review of the wonderful film Ushpizin on our show, and what can happen when guests from a long time ago in one's life come to visit. But it's a beautiful part of Sukkot. We've been having guests in our sukkah all week. It's really great. It's a nice way to reconnect with friends, and in fact we're sort of also obligated or guided to welcoming people from outside the Jewish community as well into our sukkah, so that's been really nice. And a Kabbalist practice of welcoming in as part of the Ushpizin, of welcoming in our ancestors, so forefathers and foremothers, into the sukkah. And when we do that, within the sukkah, the shadow of faith, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, sort of enters, spreads her wings above all those in the sukkah and provides protection. So that practice once more is extended to welcoming in people who we would like to have joining us. People from our lives, people who are not there. So certainly, you know, I'm thinking of having my whole family who's dispersed to come sit, and also people who have passed away, and maybe also historical people and communities as well. So there's someone recently who died this week who I will never be able to sit in a sukkah with physically and who I've never met, but someone whose life is very interesting, someone very dedicated, a Jewish resistance fighter in the Warsaw Ghetto, someone dedicated to diaspora, to justice. His name is Marek Edelman, and he passed away this week in Warsaw, where he continued to live after the Shoah. And in the last 5 minutes, I wanted to read, hopefully I can get to all of it, part of Marek Edelman's obituary.
Marek Edelman, last surviving leader of the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto uprising against the Nazis. Obituary taken from the Independent newspaper in London. All night we walked through the sewers, sometimes crawling, passageways booby-trapped with hand grenades, gas let into the mains. In a sewer where water reached our lips, we waited 48 hours to get out. Finally, two trucks halted at the trap door. In broad daylight, with almost no cover, the trap door opened, and one after another, with the stunned crowd looking on, armed Jews appeared from the depths of a black hole. These words are taken from the Ghetto Fights, Mark Edelman's stunning memoir of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943 against the Nazi Holocaust in Poland. They describe the amazing escape for the lucky few from the ghetto's burning remnants. The Nazis had finally set the ghetto on fire because, Edelman says, that was the only way they could win and, quote, save their military honor. Merrick Edelman, the last surviving leader of the five-person command group that led the uprising, died earlier this week, aged 90, in his native Poland. He will be remembered as a national hero, and whatever his misgivings about resurgent antisemitism in Poland, 3 years ago he publicly endorsed the Students and Teachers campaign to get rid of the extreme right-wing education minister, Roman Giertych. Edelman would have been delighted. He took to his grave his unshakable belief, rooted in a strong sense of humanist Judaism, forged in his teenage years as a member of the Jewish anti-Zionist socialist Bund, that racism could be overcome and that a politics which speaks to a common humanity would ultimately prevail. In his memoir, he describes the initial disbelief of Jews in their fate. Nearly 400,000 Jewish men, women, and children have been sealed into the ghetto in 1940, the prelude to the final solution, which murdered almost all of Poland's 3 million Jews, half of the final total. Paralysis and fear was the dominant move. To overcome our own terrifying apathy, to fight against our own acceptance of the generally prevailing feeling of panic, even small tasks, required truly gigantic efforts on our part, Edelman wrote. It was the children who acted first. Quote, children begged everywhere, in the ghetto as well as on the Aryan, non-Jewish side. Six-year-old boys crawled through the barbed wire under the very eyes of the gendarme in order to obtain food. Often a lone shot in the vicinity told the casual passerby that another little smuggler had died in his fight with unlimited hunger. And yet the courage of the children failed to trigger the necessary resistance. When I met him in 1989 to discuss the first-time publication of The Ghetto Fights in the UK, Edelman was still furious with the traditional Jewish leadership for seemingly allowing the ghetto passively to accept their fate. The Nazis succeeded in, quote, deporting two-thirds of the ghetto population to the death camps before the Jewish Fighting Organization was finally formed from three political parties, the Bund, the Socialist Zionists, and the Communists. For the first time, German plans were frustrated. For the first time, the halo of omnipotence and invincibility was torn from the Germans' heads. For the first time, the Jewish street realized that it was possible to do something. It was a psychological turning point. End quote. Their defeat was inevitable for the ghetto fighters. Nazi leader Goebbels paid them unintended tribute. The Jews have actually succeeded in making a defensive position of the ghetto. It shows what is to be expected of the Jews when they are in possession of arms. Unfortunately, some of their weapons were good German ones, he said. It is something argued that the ghetto fighters were isolated and defeated not just because of the dominant military position of the Nazi occupation forces, but also because of the intense anti-Semitism of the local population. Edelman always rejected this view. He refused to emigrate either to America or Israel. He became a heart surgeon in his native Poland, continuing the task of, quote, saving lives as he saw it. He remained politically active all his life, supporting the independent solidarity trade movement that would overthrow the Stalinist regime in Poland in the 1980s. At Solidarity's Congress in 1981, in the shipbuilding city of Gdansk, where the Jewish family, the veteran of the Polish underground that had led the uprising against the Nazis, 1 year after the ghetto rising in 1944, halted the applause for himself. He pointed to the hero of, quote, considerably greater stature, quote unquote, in the hall, Dr. Merrick Edelman. Communist authorities, fearful that Edelman would emerge as an iconic figure for Solidarity, offered him belated Polish military honors, which he refused. In the summer of 2002, Edelman, still going strong, intervened Israel's sexual trafficking of the now-jailed Palestinian resistance leader, Marwan Barghouti. He wrote a letter of solidarity to the Palestinian movement, and though he criticized the suicide bombers, its tone and humiliation, the Israeli government was proud. addressed his letter to the Palestinian resistance movement as follows. Commanders of the Palestinian military, paramilitary, and partisan operations, to all the soldiers of the Palestinian fighting organizations. End quote. The old Jewish anti-Nazi ghetto fighter had placed his immense moral authority at the disposal of the other side of the
Konnicht weitergehen, es konnicht weitergehen.